Hi, folks. Welcome along to another episode of Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman. Thank you so much for your ears and your time. We are slightly later with this as we were just waiting to see what the results of the BAFTA TV Awards. And quite interestingly, our conversation today covers a previous BAFTA award winner. Just before we get to that, I had a couple of nice little flurry of emails that have come in to info@edithbowman.com. Thank you so much to Grain Humphreys, who sends this really lovely message saying, "Hi, Ed, I'm getting in touch because I was one of the lucky people who attended your interview with Craig Armstrong. I'm a 30-year veteran of film festivals and film events, and that was one of the best interviews I've ever seen." Whoa, that is so much. Thank you for your incredible skill and research. It was so evident throughout the chat. That is so kind of you, Grain. Thank you so much for getting in touch. And then we had another one that came in from Julian as well, who was also at SANS, which is the film festival in St Andrews that I talked about a couple of weeks ago. So thanks so much. info@edithbowman.com is the email address if you want to get in touch. But on to our latest guest on Soundtracking, and it is none other than Richard Gadd, creator of the phenomenon that is Baby Reindeer, who joins us to discuss his new project, Half Man, which you can now watch on BBC iPlayer and HBO Max. It stars Richard and Jamie Bell as non-blood related brothers, and it tells the story of a reunion at a wedding that leads to, well, all manner of chaos. This is a really interesting look at kind of masculinity and relationships and historical trauma and family. I mean, there's so many threads running through this. It's a really brilliant and well thought out structure as well, because we do start at this wedding and then we go back. So it's got a really fascinating narrative. There's a younger pair of actors that play the younger versions of Richard and Jamie's characters, and everyone is at the top of their game. It's so great. It's really dark. It kind of goes there, but that's one of the things I think that we love and admire about Richard, is that he's not scared to cover subjects and write about things that most people would be scared of. The score for Half Man isn't available as yet, but it features plenty of needle drops. And so we'll begin with one from the first episode, Clever Trevor.
Just cause I ain't never had no nothing worth having, never, ever, never, ever. You ain't got no call not to think of what I'm falling to thinking I ain't too clever. And it ain't not having one thing, nor not another either, neither is it anything, whatever. And it's not knowing that there ain't nothing showing in the eyes to the name of Trevor.
How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really good. It's really great to have time with you to chat about your show. Congratulations, man. It's like...
Oh, have you seen it all?
Yeah, watched it all. Yeah, Listen, I think that there's important conversations that needs to throw up, and that's something that you never shy away from in terms of when it's a project that you're writing. What was the starting point for this for you, Richard, in terms of wanting to tell the story? Am I right in thinking it was even before Baby Reindeer you sort of started this?
Yeah, it was back in 2019. You know, I don't really know really what influenced it. I'm assuming there was a lot of conversations around broken men or broken masculinity back then. And I guess I just sort of must have thought of an idea where you take two sort of broken men, about as broken as they can be, in the present life, and you flash back to their childhood and contextualize what it took to get them to that point. And that was kind of the idea. But really, once I just sort of have a creative idea, that becomes the kind of motivation and the driving force. So I think once I started to kind of figure out a kind of atypical structure, or they just figure out who these two characters are and why I'm exploring them, that's all I kind of needed to kind of see all the way through to the end.
Do you find that kind of, that process, you know, when you're writing it, in terms of, because I mean, the journey that we go on as a viewer with these characters, with each episode, you know, you kind of like, you take a moment after each episode just to kind of gather yourself, to be honest, and reflect on what you've just watched and where these characters are. Do you write with that in mind, in terms of like kind of chapters almost, in a way, in terms of how the audience are going to experience it, as well as how you want to give the actors the opportunity to play and explore these characters, both those sides, I guess.
In terms of the like giving people a break, I suppose I came up with an atypical structure that kind of interested me to a certain degree. Like,
yeah,
in terms of like you flash back, you you know, from this wedding, this unexplained event, and you kind of take us through all the different sort of epochs in the boys' lives leading up to that point. Yeah, it just to me felt like a kind of interesting way of doing it. And you have these gaps in time, almost like part of the show's art, hopefully, would be to filling the gaps and kind of figure out what's happened in the meantime, where the relationships are at. It's a very challenging writing process because you have to almost recontextualize every single time you get to an episode.
I find that notion quite interesting. I was really interested to talk to you about constructing that thing of these episodes that all together tell this full story, but within each episode, it has to have its own kind of start, middle and end, I guess is what
exactly,
I was trying
exactly.
to say.
Yeah, you know, it was in a lot of ways, I look back at it and I think it was almost like a six, not short films, because you can't call 60 minutes short, but it was like six films in kind of one series. And they had to kind of exist as their own story. It was the kind of great challenge of writing it in a lot of ways, was kind of writing six different films and putting them all together as one.
Yeah.
And trying to enter a structure that hopefully works. And that was a real challenge, but that was the intention, yeah.
So interesting in terms of how we feel about these characters as we're watching it as well. And kind of almost you're kind of rooting for them both to get to that point that we see occasionally where they're both being kind to each other and themselves, I guess, you know, in terms of it doesn't happen that often, but there are those moments where you go, God, they love each other. They're good for each other. And do you know what I mean? They're there for each other. But obviously their own experience, their own perception of themselves and the world definitely influences then what triggers things, I think, to take them out of that kind of like safe space almost in a way. I don't know how you write that. It's so brilliant and so clever.
Oh, I really appreciate that. That's very kind of you. Thank you. Yeah, I suppose like that they have a love as characters that kind of, for better or for worse, is what drives them. Like a love for one another. It's almost unexplained. It's certainly toxic, I suppose. And but I sometimes think like a lot of human beings, not everyone, but certainly people I know, and you know, they look back on some of the times where they felt the most emotion for someone, and or felt the most love for someone in a way, and the ones we remember are sometimes the ones that are the most complicated and most difficult. The ones where the love is intertwined with all kinds of feelings of sort of neediness and desire and feelings of rejection and abandonment. And those relationships seem to be, I think, what we pedestal as human beings in our heads is the most like strong examples of love in a way. And I think that Niall and Reuben have that. They have that for whatever reason. They have like a love for each other that they cannot express. And it mutates into so many different and damaging forms.
The connection as well between the two different versions of the characters, you know, the young Niall and Reuben sort of thing. Were you involved in the casting side of things as well? Because, I mean, the casting's fantastic.
Yeah. No, I'm massively involved in casting. I really obsess about it and make sure we get it right. And yeah, I really love these boys. And not just them, you know, I think of all the ones, you know, all the young cast, Albie, Joanna, you know, all these people. I think it's so special. We had a screening last night. I saw it all again, and because I'm so used to, you know, not just chatting to the boys, you know, speaking to Stuart Mitchell so regularly, we're doing all my press around the show now. I'm so used to speaking to that I forget all these other characters. So when you go to a screening, you see them all again, and they're all just such amazing actors and wonderful performers. And I hope they all get what they need out of it.
How was it watching it? Can you take a step back and just watch it, or how is that for you?
Never, you know, I watched, I turned to my agent after the screening was finished yesterday and I said, I think I managed to relax in the last 2 minutes of episode two. So that was the only time I felt like I was kind of, other than that, I was kind of just aware of all the kind of noise in the room or just like kind of overthinking everything.
Yeah.
You know, making a TV show is hard and I'm not good at letting go. And it's just like it's a funny old process.
Totally. Yeah. Well, especially when it's you're the creator, you know, you've written it, you've poured so much into this, you're also in it. And then being so involved in it, you know, in terms of the production side of it as well, it must be kind of, you know, many hats to wear. And so you're almost kind of wearing a bit of a kind of mashup of hats whilst you're watching it in terms of like everybody's job that you've, all the jobs you've had on this show are kind of like manifesting, I guess, in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, show running is really hard. You're kind of across all sort of creative decisions. And yeah, I guess it's being the face of a show like I was with Baby Reindeer. You know, there's pressure everywhere, really. Television shows are pressure in every respect, times, deadlines, the amount of voices you have to satisfy all the way through to, multiple different jobs, having to act and then go behind the monitor, go in front of the monitor, go behind the monitor. Yeah, it's a crazy pressurizing thing. And I think when you get so caught up in all of that, it's even harder to let go of it.
What would you say you kind of, the biggest learning curve was from Baby Reindeer into this?
Well, I think Baby Reindeer, biggest learning curve was, you know, working as hard as you possibly can, really. I mean, I gave Baby Reindeer everything. Like, I guess I was rewarded for that. And then I thought, well, if that's the work ethic you need, I suppose, if you want a show to be in any way decent, I guess. And I sort of took that work ethic and applied it to Half Man. And I sort of worked as hard on Half Man as I did on Baby Reindeer. And yeah, and I guess that's it. I mean, I think working hard is everything. And at least, you know, if you work hard, you can never look back and say you didn't. And yeah. So that's a big driver as well.
Got to mention Jamie Bell as well, because it's just a joyful to see Jamie on screen, like for this amount of time as well. And there's a great, that's a fascinating character for him to play. Mm. Do you know what I mean? I think as well, in terms of, I don't know, that's the clever thing about your writing, is that you think you feel one way about, or you think you've read a character, and then you're like, hold on a minute. It's so nuanced and surprising as well. Why Jamie? Why was Jamie the right person for that role?
Thanks for your kind words, by the way. I don't know. He sort of came into my head at one stage during the sort of casting process. I think we were just talking about dream actors for roles. And it's not necessarily that we're looking to cast dream actors for every role, because actually I prefer casting unknowns. I think it adds to art in a sense of sort of anonymity when it comes to
project. You're not coming with baggage to it, are you?
Yeah, exactly. All kinds of things. But I said Jamie is like dream casting, and I sort of couldn't get it out of my head. I think he's a wonderful actor, and even though he's been in loads of things and done loads of amazing things, I still would consider him underrated. And I thought he'd bring an amazing vulnerability to it, as well as the humour and everything in between. But I've never done that, where I've sort of offered a role to someone before. I've never done it. But there was something about it that spoke to me that made it feel quite clear.
Did you just give him a script?
I think I sent him episode one, maybe. I met episode one and two at that point. I'm trying to think where in the process this was. It was such a mad scramble, the whole thing.
Was it?
Oh, yeah. The whole thing was taking about 2 years, you know.
Wow.
So that's from like writing all the way through to, you know, filming and editing it. And the whole thing's been like 2 years. And it's a lot to do. You know, it's over 600 television. It's a lot. You know? So I moved to Glasgow for a year and a half.
Did you? How was that?
I loved it. I loved Glasgow. I have such good memories there from being a student. So it's lovely being back up. I mean, I mainly lived in an edit suite the whole time. I still loved it.
Yeah. I was just up there actually with my my oldest son. He's looking at it. He wants to go there and study zoology. So we were just up at Glasgow Uni a couple of weeks ago, which was really exciting, actually. Yeah, I'd love him to go there. I wanted to ask you about that in terms of when you were writing it. Location does feed into so much of a show. It's a mood. It's a character. It's a background for so much that the character's backstory and where they've come from and things as well. And I was just interested to find out about if it was always going to be kind of Scotland and where you set it and shot it and stuff as well.
Yeah. I mean, I've always loved Scottish identity. I'm from Scotland and I love Scottish identity on screen. I think it's a much overlooked place in terms of sort of film output and TV output. I wanted to kind of give back in that respect. But moreover, I thought it was an interesting setting. Not only do I think it's like a rugged nation that fits within the prism of masculinity in a lot of ways, I think there is a camaraderie to the country that also works well within the context of the story. But also back in Glasgow, you know, it's an ever-changing city. It's a city that back in, you know, when I was growing up was considered a scary city. At least that was what we thought in our kind of small town. And then now you look at Glasgow and it's this kind of cultural capital of the country, of the world. It's and it's got a thriving sort of LGBT community, a hugely cosmopolitan area. And it's progressed in such a rapid way over the past few decades that I thought, where better to set a backdrop against these two repressed men that can't seem to evolve in their own life? Put them in a city that's changing faster than they are.
It's one of the things I'm very proud of about Scotland, is about how progressive it is, you know, in terms of so many kind of areas. And it doesn't get kind of celebrated for that enough, I don't think at all.
No, you feel it when you're up there. You feel that everyone's kind of one. What's that phrase that people always say? Like, Glasgow is the people that make Glasgow. Do you know that phrase?
Yeah. It's the people. It's the people that make Glasgow, isn't it? And you're so right.
True.
Yeah, and I think that about. I was just up in Aberdeen actually at the weekend, and it's like same up there. It's kind of like it's such a beautiful multicultural city, which I don't think most people would realize. You know, and it's kind of like it's extraordinary. It's just like, God, it's brilliant. It's so good. One of the pull-throughs between Baby Reindeer and this was your composers as well. And I was interested to kind of chat to you about that and about how involved you kind of get in that side of things.
I'm kind of massively involved in all sides of things. Like I sort of, I get forensic in sort of everything, and, you know, I'm very obsessive. And, you know, I love what they did with Baby Reindeer. I've loved what they've done with Half Man. I was keen to work with them again. I sent them the scripts, and they've done another fantastic job. I definitely feed in regularly and a lot, but they've worked with me on two shows now and they know what I'm like. But they bring less to the table. They're just so, I don't know, experimental and playful and sort of unique and just find such unique ways to get to the characters' souls. Like, yeah, I love them.
When you're having conversations with them, though, what's your musical vocabulary and language, or is it coming from a feeling and emotion or narrative and stuff, you know, in terms of, and did you have clear ideas about what you wanted for this show, considering there are kind of two time sort of scales going on within it as well, and lean into that, lean away from that? Yeah,
we had loads of discussions about that. Anytime I got any resistance, I just pull out my grade two piano and
say, get you far in life, Richard. Get you far in life.
No, they were great. And I, you know, yeah, we had loads of discussions about it. We wanted like a brother's theme. You hear at the start, you know, when we first have Ruben, and we wanted it to kind of grow and evolve and mutate as we move through it. I love the way they write suspense. I could pick out so many, you know, moments that the composers did that I loved. And you know, I remember there was one in an episode where all the nails on a driveway. I think it's incredible score. The way they tap into emotion. You know, there's quite a lot of emotional scenes in the show, and I think they always underscore them with superb poignancy and real death sort of composition. I think they're great. And sometimes, like, they come in, what I like about them is they come in sometimes with something just kind of crazy, or it just works. Yeah, I would love to. I keep resisting the urge to tell you exactly the bits that they sometimes just come in with something so crazy, and you're like, why wouldn't I think of it that way? But it really adds something special, you know?
Yeah, I hear a lot of people when I talk to them for soundtrack, and where they go, it just seeing it with picture and it felt right. And it's almost kind of like what the show was telling me it needed.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can have as many conversations as you want, but when you actually put them together, it works. And it's kind of like, that's what we needed.
Yes, exactly. And that's what they're real special at.
What about needle drops? What's your kind of thought on needle drops and existing music in shows? And if you're writing things into a script, or then it's like, well, we've got to get clearance before we know we can have this in. And that whole journey as well is interesting, isn't it?
It is interesting, yeah. And I've been on it, you know, it could be really interesting. It could be really painful as well.
Heartbreaking.
You can be completely attached to a song and then you can't get it cleared. Or
they want £1 million for 20 seconds.
Unbelievable. I mean, I'd love to take you through all the songs that you know, tried and failed across both shows, you know, like it would make for some interesting reading. I'll tell you off the record.
Okay. I think there's going to be a lot of people that would be kicking themselves if they had been asked to be in Baby Reindeer and they'd said no. Do you know what I mean?
Well, there were plenty of them before. Yeah, but I always just like, it's something I obsess over, you know, I always create a playlist, and I don't listen to it when I'm writing, but I listen to it like religiously if I go to the gym or I'm running or something. And I just try and find the soul of a show through music. And so the needle drops mean a lot to me. That not only are they useful in the show in terms of era and sort of stamping a bit of time on the episodes, but they're important in terms of just really honoring a moment, honoring a character's soul and stuff like that. And I'm a big fan of needle drops. I think soundtracks and the composition are so important in the overall feel of the show.
Have you got soundtracks that are important to you as a fan that you return to or that you remember being impactful on you?
It's a good question. I mean, my mind instantly goes to probably the most famous movie soundtrack of all time, which would be Trainspotting. But it always goes to there. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a song used better in something than Lou Reed's Perfect Day when he sinks into the carpet.
I love that you picked that scene as opposed to so many other people would have done Lust for Life.
Well, Lust for Life was another great example. And there's the Underworld one as well in there. But that, you know, I mean, that, I've got it on vinyl, that Trainspotting soundtrack. But that always springs to mind, soundtracks-wise, as one that I think is particularly influential, not just on me, but I guess on almost the whole culture. You know?
Yeah, totally. I had the weirdest experience last summer going to see Oasis at Murrayfield.
Where were you?
It was amazing. Yeah. Oh my God, it was so good. I was with my brother. Well, there was actually three generations of Bowmans there. It was amazing. But I was sat with my brother and we were going in and out and watching the bands. And so they started playing music before Oasis came out. We were like properly like pumped and ready for this. Underworld, they played Underworld, Born Slippy. And we were like on our way out with our pints in one hand, fist pump in the other one, get to our seat. Who sat in front of us whilst Underworld is playing? Irvin Welsh. And I was no way, this is so weird.
That's amazing. Did you speak to him?
Yeah, we got our picture taken with him. Oh, the funny thing is, it was like with this collection of like bald middle-aged men, and I was like, which one's Begbie? Which one's like? Totally.
Have you read his letter that he wrote to the writer of?
No.
It was Del Hodge, wasn't it? The screen.
Yeah.
He wrote this amazing letter to him that was kind of like about Begbie's character and basically saying that Begbie wouldn't speak this way. He would speak like this. And then he just writes like a line of just aggressive swearing. It's a really great letter. And it is clear that John Hodge took it on board. It's Irvin Welsh wrote to him. And yeah, it's a fascinating letter to read.
I need to find that. What were kind of inspirations for you in terms of your writing, you know, in terms of finding stories to tell, and who were the people that you kind of admired and were kind of inspirational for you in that sense?
Well, I would say Shane McGowan is probably the biggest one, and the Pogues. I mean, my life has been kind of informed by the Pogues and sort of in a lot of ways saved by the Pogues. I mean, I always felt like in any time of hardship, I would discover a song or revisit a song that, I don't know, spoke to me in times of trouble, you know, and I think he's like a lyrical genius. I think there's a reason why, you know, every time Dylan or Springsteen or whatever were over in Ireland, they go visit him. You know, I think they admired him too.
And, yeah.
You know, I think, you know, like there's so many, am I allowed to swear?
Yeah.
There are so many lyrics of his. There's so many lyrics of his that I just think of, like, I mean, I always remember like the lyric, man's ambition must indeed be small to write his name upon a shithouse wall. That's just such an amazing lyric. And, you know, and I just like so much of stuff has like spoke to me down the years. And like, you know, I remember like in particular times of hardship, it was like, and then there was a song they did called Dark Streets of London, which was their first ever single that they released. And it was like, and the winter comes down, I can't stand the chill, I can't stand the streets around Christmas time, and I'm buggered to damnation, and I haven't got a penny to wander the dark streets of London. And it was just so indicative of my life around then and that time. I just couldn't believe somebody had written that because it spoke to me.
Yeah.
The way that nothing else did.
That's beautiful. Have you thought about the conversations you want people to have off the back of watching Half Man? You know, in terms of, it's a show that warrants people talking about, you know, in terms of finding things in their own experiences that it encourages them to share or ask questions or just talk about the show, you know, in terms of a piece of entertainment and a piece of drama. And I wondered whether there was, I don't know, things that were important for you to come out of the show, I guess.
And it was sort of right with a kind of like overall kind of feeling for people to take out in a way.
Yeah.
Like I never really write with a social political message. And I guess I worry sometimes about, like, I think too much that art and TV and film in this day and age makes it a bit too obvious what it wants you to take out of it almost.
Yeah.
But I really want people to just take what they need or what they want out of it, or really just to enjoy it. I mean, people often ask me like, yeah, like what do you want this show to say? And I'm like, well, what do you think it says? And they'll say something that what they think it is. And I'm like, well, it's probably that. And and that's the kind of hopefully myriad type of responses that I would hope for something like this. Ultimately, my work will always be a canvas for people to take what they need from it, I think.
It's a bit like what you were saying about Shane McGowan and the lyrics in terms of once an artist releases an album, it's not theirs anymore. It's what fans and how they connect to it and what they get from it in a way. So I like that sentiment for your shows as well in terms of taking a bit of Shane into how you release TV shows. It's great, isn't it?
Absolutely. I sort of take them everywhere I go in a way.
Is it nice then kind of doing shows where you're not involved in every department, so to speak? You're just rocking up to play a role. See, the husbands is something that I'm looking forward to seeing. Is that nice where it's just the one thing sort of thing, or do you kind of get a bit like itchy?
It's a dream.
Okay.
No, I love it. Husbands was a pleasure. I loved Julia Temple and working with her, and it was a dream. It's like it's one job, you know. When you're showrunner, it's not just it's everything. It's you know, it's the writing and the producing and the management and the everything and the creative
and the promotion, all of that.
Yeah, and the acting. It's so much all at once. And the promotion. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, it's kind of a 24/7 job. So when you turn up to act, you've got like a singular focus. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. And I guess there must be that thing off the back of the success of Baby Reindeer where there's, you know, there's an element of not pressure sort of thing, but expectation from people in terms of how well that show did as well. And for you to find ways to kind of almost eliminate that noise, I guess, in a way.
Yeah, I'm aware the pressure's there. I'm aware the expectation is there. Ultimately, like whenever I do a show and I commit to something and like broadcasters expect something from me or anyone expects something from me, that becomes the pressure. And I just kind of tunnel vision into just trying to make something as good as I possibly can. So the pressure I feel elsewhere, yeah, I know it's there. It's probably creeping up on me a bit more now that the show's coming out.
And it's gone.
Yeah.
It's not yours anymore. It's gone.
I know, it's crazy. So I'm starting to feel it a bit now. But during the writing of it, the pressures internally in the production, the pressures of just getting it on were the pressures, if that makes sense.
And listen, huge congratulations.
Thank you.
I'm really looking forward to Husbands as well and whatever you create next as well, because it's, it always kind of takes us really interesting places and thoroughly entertains us. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I know it's out of fashion and a trifle uncool, but I can't help it, I'm a romantic fool. It's a habit of mine to watch the sun go down. On Echo Beach, I watch the sun go down. From 9 to 5, I have to spend my time at work. My job is very boring, I'm an office clerk. The only thing that helps me pass the time away is knowing I'll be back at Echo Beach someday.
As featured in Half Man, that's Echo Beach by Martha and Muffins. Rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Richard Gadd. My huge thanks to Richard for taking the time to talk to us. It's been a long time coming. I've been trying to get a chance to chat to him for absolutely ages. Half Man is available to stream now on BBC iPlayer and HBO Max. EdithBowman.com is the place to catch up with every single episode of the podcast. In fact, we heard Richard talking about Trainspotting, so if you want to dive into a couple of Trainspotting episodes, there are plenty up there with Danny Boyle and the likes. You can also follow us on your socials. We're at Soundtracking UK, and we've also got a YouTube channel called Soundtracking Extra, which we'd very much appreciate you subscribing to. Next up, a complete change of vibe as Elliot Hegarty and Dominic Treadwell Collins join me to discuss Season 2 of Rivals, which you can watch on Disney+. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.